The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin from Singapore with a wake-up call coming to you live on the 28th of November 2011. And I hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. It does seem to me just to get harder each year to know exactly what to give thanks for, but I'll leave that for you to decide. Ladies and gentlemen, my message today is grimmer than it has ever been since I started these shows. The global economy is heading for a horrendous amount of trouble in the months ahead. Right now, we're seeing the beginning of a credit crunch that is shaping up to be very reminiscent of what we saw back in 2008, but much more serious. Investors and big corporations are pulling huge amounts of money out of European banks, and nobody wants to lend to those banks right now. We could potentially see dozens of Lehman Brothers moments in Europe in 2012. And meanwhile, bond yields on sovereign debt are jumping through the roof all over Europe. What this means is that European nations that are already drowning in debt are going to be much more expensive to continue funding that debt. It would be a huge understatement to say that there is a financial chaos in Europe right now. A full-scale bond panic is accelerating, and the rift between Germany and France is growing. It's getting harder and harder for the desperate Eurozone leaders to find some way of delaying the final disaster. It may well be only a few weeks now. People, of course, are hoping that the US can escape the consequences, but that's a fantasy. A bank run across Europe will quickly devastate the economies of the United States and China and the Middle East, and even worse, will inexorably lead to conflict and war. The European financial system is in so much trouble that it is really hard to find words to describe the financial horror. The instant that Greece stops receiving bailout money, it'll default. Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Spain, and quite a few other European nations are also on the verge of massive financial problems. When the financial dominoes start to fall, the U.S. financial system will be dramatically affected as well, because United States banks have a huge amount of exposure to European debt. The country is in a lot of trouble, and things are going to get really ugly. You see, the United States never recovered from the last major financial crisis 3 years ago. The U.S. economy today is far weaker than it was in 2007. So let's see if we can get a handle on what's going to happen when we get hit with the next financial tsunami. This is what PIMCO CEO Mohammed El Arian said recently, and I quote, "What's most terrifying is that we're having this discussion about the risk of recession at a time when unemployment is already too high, at a time when a quarter of homeowners are underwater on their mortgages, at a time when the financial deficit is at 9%, and at a time when interest rates are at zero. End of quote. So you may be wondering if things can really get much worse than they are now. And the answer is, yes, unfortunately, they can. Not that things aren't really bad right now. In Los Angeles earlier last week, approximately 10,000 people lined up for free turkey dinners. So you have to wonder how many people will be lining up for free food when the U3 unemployment rate in the U.S. soars into double digits. I'm not, of course, talking about the U6 measure or John Williams' assessment, and he's talking about 22% right now. Right now, there is a devastating amount of economic pain in America. According to a recent report from one non-profit group, 45% of all people living in the United States, quote, do not have enough money to cover housing, food, health care, and other basic expenses, end of quote. If this is where we are now, how much trouble will the nation be in when the financial crisis that hits in 2012, which is going to be a lot worse than 2008? The primary cause of the coming financial crisis will almost certainly be the financial meltdown that we're seeing unfold in Europe. The economic downturn that began in 2008 caused the debt levels of quite a few European nations to soar to unprecedented heights. It's got to the point where the debts of many of those nations are no longer sustainable. So investors are starting to demand much higher returns for the much greater risk associated with investing in the bonds of those countries. But what makes it much more expensive for those troubled nations to fund their debts? That means that their financial troubles get even worse. Over the past 12 months, bond yields in Europe have been spiking even while the European Central Bank has been buying up unprecedented mountains of bonds in an attempt to keep bond yields low. There has been a fundamental loss of faith in the financial system, and it's not just happening in Europe. Credit default swap spreads all over the globe are skyrocketing, and are now higher than we have seen at any point since the great financial crisis that shook the world during 2008 and 2009. Panic and fear are everywhere, especially in Europe. Credit default swap spreads all over the globe look like causing a run on the banks, which has already begun in Europe. And here's a comment from a recent article in The Economist, and I quote, "We are starting to witness signs that corporates are withdrawing deposits from banks in Spain, Italy, France, and Belgium," end of quote. And that's from an analyst at Citigroup. And I continue, "This is a worrying development. Nobody wants to lend money to European banks right now. There is a feeling that they are all vulnerable and could fail at any time. And this lack of confidence actually makes that possibility even more likely." End of quote. And the following comes from a recent CNBC article, and I quote, "Money funds in the United States have quite dramatically slammed shut their lending windows to European banks. According to The Economist, Fitch estimates U.S. market money funds have withdrawn 42% of their money from European banks in general. And for France, that number is even higher, 69%. European money market funds are also getting in on the act. This is kind of like watching a horrific car wreck happen in very slow motion. End of quote. The financial system of Europe is dying, and everybody can see what is happening, but nobody can find a way to fix it. Not that the problems in the United States are being solved either. The vaunted super committee that was supposed to deal with the debt problem was a complete and utter failure. Barack Obama has shown that he has no clue what to do when it comes to the economy. And Ben Bernanke has been preoccupied with roaming around the country trying to get people to feel more warm and fuzzy about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve actually has more power over the economy than anyone else. But instead of fixing things, they only keep making things even worse. The only people that the Fed seems to be helping are the bankers. Here's something I didn't expect to be able to read, but which has somehow found the light of day. According to a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, the Federal Reserve has actually been tipping off their upcoming moves to top financial professionals. In turn, these financial professionals have been using that information to make a lot of money for themselves and for their clients. And I quote, "Hours after an August 15th meeting with Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke in his office, Nancy Lazar made a hasty call to investor clients. The Fed was dusting off an obscure 1960s-era strategy known as Operation Twist. The news pointed to a boom in long-term bonds. It was a good call. Over the next 5 weeks, prices on 10-year Treasury bonds soared, offering double-digit returns in an otherwise dismal year. By the time the Fed announced its $400 billion Operation Twist on September the 21st, the window for quick profits had all but slammed shut. Ms. Lazar is among a group of well-connected investors and analysts with access to top Federal Reserve officials who give them a chance at early clues to the central bank's next policy moves, according to interviews and hundreds of pages of documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal through open records searches." End of quote. You just can't make this stuff up. The corruption at the Federal Reserve is totally out of control. After nearly 100 years of total failure, it is time to shut down the Federal Reserve. Not that Barack Obama should get a free pass for the role that he has played in this economic downturn. He inherited a complete mess from Bush and has made it even worse. Today, millions of owners are so frustrated with Washington, D.C. that they don't know what to do. For example, one business owner down in Georgia has posted signs with the following message on all of his company's trucks. Quote, "New company policy. We are not hiring until Obama is gone." End of quote. The business environment in the country becomes more toxic with each passing year, and the federal government has already strangled millions of small businesses out of existence. In addition, politicians from both parties continue to stand aside as tens of thousands of businesses, millions of jobs, and hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth get shipped out of the United States. During 2010, an average of 23 manufacturing facilities a day were shut down in the U.S. The country is committing national economic suicide, and the top politicians in both political parties keep cheering for more. Well, millions of ordinary Americans can see what is happening, and they are preparing for the worst. The following report comes from an article that was recently posted on the website of the local CBS affiliate in St. Louis. Quote, "A chain of three stores that sell survival food and gear reports a jump in sales to people who are getting prepared for the possible collapse of society," We had to order 50 cases of the meals ready to eat and keep up with the demand in the past 3 months, said manager Steve Dorsey at Uncle Sam's Safari Outfitters, Inc. in Webster Groves. That's not normal. Usually we sell 20 to 30 cases in a whole year. End of quote. Let there be no doubt. The U.S. economy is going to get a lot worse in the years ahead. My advice to you is to become a lot less dependent on the system, because the system is failing. A whole lot of trouble is coming, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let me give you my information. The toll-free number for you to call is 888-874-4888. That's your number to call in with your comments, questions, and rants. Once more, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. And if you want to send in your comments by email, please do so. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, and GFAWD, which is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my number, for those of you who would like to call me direct to discuss your affairs, financial, economic, and otherwise. Well, let's forget about the otherwise for the time being, but financial and economic will do just fine. The number is, number in Sarasota, 941-411-1682. Let's try once more. The number to call me directly is area code 941-441-1682. And so let me conclude by reminding you of the next meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group to be held in New Brunswick, New Jersey, next Sunday, December the 4th at 2 p.m. It is going to be held at the George Street Ale House, which is located at 378 George Street in New Brunswick. Susan is the new moderator. She's taken over from Lou, and I would please ask you to call her and let her know you're coming. And I cannot recommend it more, ladies and gentlemen. The clouds are gathering, and you are being hemmed in from all sides. It's not enough to talk about the financial and economic situation of the United States. It seems to me that the geopolitical situation is heating up very fast indeed, with the United States' decision now to put in 2,500 Marines into northern Australia to get as close as they can in a friendly country to China. This is very, very serious. Not content with having done enough trouble in the Middle East, it seems that America is now flexing its muscles in Asia. This causes me some concern, but as I said the other day, until Singapore makes the decision to support one or other side, we will remain put here. But the day Singapore throws its lot in with the Chinese or the Americans, one or the other, my wife and I will move. So it's up to you, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be very grim in so many different respects in the United States. It's hard to know where to start. But you need to make your decision. And you need to be in company with other people of a like mind. And that is what you will find on December the 4th at 2 p.m. in New Brunswick at the Richard Martin Meetup Group. And I'm sure Susan will have some good things for you. And I hope that you will have some good things for her too. But one way or another, try to make it if you possibly can. That's December the 4th, Sunday next, at 2 p.m. All right, well, It seems that according to economists, the housing prices in the United States won't recover until 2013. U.S. home prices will stagnate through next year and only start recovering in 2013, according to economists polled by Reuters, who also felt the stimulus options being floated will not do much to reinvigorate the market. It's otherwise known as more promises of green shoots. So I have to wonder why they chose 2013. Why will housing have a resurgence? I have to kind of wonder what they're talking about, but anyway, that's what they say. Without jobs, you have to wonder who will be buying all these houses. It looks like U.S. jobs will only be returning when people are willing to work for third world wages. At those wages, houses will have to fall for many years. Yes, of course, they're talking about cardboard housing. Well, that comes to you from Steve Kruger, likely edited by myself, for effect. But Steve, as always, has got the right idea. Thank you, Steve, for your good and worthwhile help in that regard. Kevin Moran wrote in also. He said, I think the U.S. Post Office, and this, by the way, comes on the heels of my comment about the U.S. Post Office going bankrupt the other day. He says, I think the U.S. Post Office provides very good service, but they need to slash payroll and eliminate the highly favorable rates for bulk third and fourth class postage. Postage employees have referred to third class as the full employment service guarantee. Let every parcel be charged first class and usage will plummet. Then the Post Office can reduce employment and start shuttering facilities. Next, eliminate Saturday delivery and possibly even reduce weekday delivery to 2 or 3 days. Nothing is forever. We used to send many documents overnight multiple times. Then we sent them by curly thermal fax sheets. Now we send the documents in PDF format. That transition took 10 to 15 years. The U.S. Post Office has changed little over the past 30 years. Kevin Moran. Thank you for that, Kevin. Excellent work from you on behalf of all of us. Well, do you know which day in the year is National Hype the Fabricated Data Day? Well, it's Monday after Black Friday. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, today. Every year at this time, we get a series of loose reports about Black Friday and the holiday weekend. Every year, they are wildly optimistic. And like clockwork, the media idiotically repeats these trade organizations' spin like it's gospel. But when the data finally comes in, we learn that the early reports were pure hokum put out by trade groups to create shopping hype for Christmas. Let's start with this whopper from an utterly breathless press release from the National Retail Federation, NRF, and I quote, U.S. retail sales during Thanksgiving weekend climbed 16% to a record as shoppers flocked to stores earlier and spent more, according to the National Retail Federation. Sales totaled $52.4 billion, and the average shopper spent $398.62 during the holiday weekend, up from $365.34 a year earlier, the Washington-based trade group said in a statement today, citing a survey conducted by BIG Research. More than a third of that, an average of $150.53, was spent online. End of quote. No, retail sales did not climb 16%. Surveys where people forecast their own future spending are pretty much worthless, as we have seen repeatedly in the press. We actually have no idea just yet as to whether and exactly by how much sales may or may not have climbed. The data simply isn't in yet. The most you can accurately say is, according to some foot traffic measurements, more people appeared to be in stores on Black Friday 2011 than in 2010. Here's another absurd example. Does anyone actually believe nearly one quarter, that's 24.4%, of Black Friday shoppers were at the stores by midnight on Black Friday? Perhaps the National Retail Federation, competing with the National Association of Realtors for title of most ridiculous trade group. Next up is ShopperTrack, who claimed a 6.6% gain in sales, and I quote, "Shoppers packed stores and spent money in record numbers on Black Friday. Early surveys show a phenomenon that analysts call a hopeful sign for the U.S. economy after months of up-and-down consumer spending. Black Friday sales were up 6.6% over last year, and foot traffic in stores was up 5.1%, according to ShopperTrack, a Chicago-based research firm. The year-to-year spending increase was the greatest since 2007, the firm reported." End of quote. So what exactly is the basis of that 6.6% gain? ShopperTrack, quote, "uses equipment installed in stores to measure traffic," end of quote. But that does not measure changes in window shoppers versus buyers from year to year, how much money and or credit people have, how large their holiday budgets are, or how much they're willing to spend. It is a very poor system for forecasting actual sales. The fact that the National Retail Federation and ShopperTrack are so widely disparate confirms, at least for me, that one of their methodologies is suspect. Ah, want the truth? They're both meaningless. All right, well, I think we've... Well, a little message from me. Another warning about commercial money market funds. I'll give you that just before our break here. Fed's promise to keep rates exceptionally low through 2013 means the basic business model of these money market funds will remain challenging, and some of them have now begun waiving fees, quote, "in order to avoid a situation in which investors realize negative interest rates on their savings," end of quote. Well, traditionally, retail money markets have enjoyed a relatively stable shareholder base, since households are more interested in net asset value stability than the return on their assets. That means they don't necessarily withdraw cash from the money market funds when rates fall, as would an institutional account. But in this ultra-low interest rate environment, cash is migrating from money funds, and a significant portion of the outflow is going into savings accounts at depository institutions. Investment companies, however, are seeing some of the money market fund outflow being redirected up the risk chain to bond mutual funds. You know, I have to say, the quicker these money market funds come under pressure, the better. These funds are and always have been nothing more than shadow banking vehicles, and they came into existence by regulatory arbitrage. They avoid capital constraints, reserve requirements, and deposit insurance charges, and assiduously defend their right to do so. They're especially vulnerable in these times, and the real but unpalatable truth is that they serve no real purpose other than to circumvent the banking system. They refuse to use mark-to-market accounting, preferring straight-line amortization, tell shareholders that the net asset value is not guaranteed, and then play the financial system to ensure that they are. Let's not forget they took free insurance in 2008. So the excuse that they have never been bailed out is rubbish. Ladies and gentlemen, again, you have been warned. All right, let's take a break, and I will be right back. Okay, we are back. Long-time listeners will know that I have questioned Warren Buffett's success for as long as I can remember. And, you know, here's the second or third richest man in the world with decades of success picking stocks in the stock market. And here am I doubting the intrinsic success of his work. Along comes a fascinating article in the Financial Times discussing not Warren Buffett, but Bill Miller, another fabulously successful investor with a 30-year track record who bit the dust 5 years ago and whose investment results have been going down ever since. In The Drunkard's Walk, Caltech physicist Leonard Mlodinow's book about how people misunderstand the amount of randomness in their lives, there's a short but fascinating passage discussing Bill Miller's 15-year streak, beginning in 1991, of beating the S&P 500. Mlodinow's book is what first came to mind when we heard the news last week that Miller was stepping down from the Legg Mason Value Trust Fund, which he'd managed for 30 years. In the 5 years since the streak ended, Miller's fund lost 9% annually and ranked dead last out of the 840 funds in its category, according to Lipper. Predictably, most of the commentary we've seen has focused on his spectacular crash after his equally spectacular run. The most obvious reason that most people consider the streak so extraordinary, and Miller to be such an impressive stock picker, was that the odds of any single mutual fund generating such a run were so infinitesimally small. Perhaps luck could account for a few good bets or a couple of good years, the thinking went, but surely it couldn't account for such extraordinary and sustained outperformance. A newsletter published by Credit Suisse First Boston in 2003, a few years before the streak ended, calculated the odds of a manager outperforming the market on chance alone for 12 straight years to be 1 in 2.2 billion. But what if Miller's streak wasn't so remarkable to begin with? The statisticians, like those from Credit Suisse First Boston, were considering the odds that a specific fund would outperform for 12 straight years if the fund begins investing at a specific time. But as Mlodinow explained, maybe the better question to ask is actually this. Given the number of mutual funds that have existed in the modern era, what are the odds that any of them would have beaten the market over any 15-year period of time on chance alone? Answer, 3 out of 4. Here's the relevant excerpt from the book. Those who quoted the low odds were right in one sense. If you had singled out Bill Miller in particular at the start of 1991, in particular, and calculated the odds that by pure chance the specific person you selected would beat the market for precisely the next 15 years, then those odds would indeed have been astronomically low. You would have had the same odds against you if you had flipped a coin once a year for 15 years with the goal of having it land heads up each time. But as in the Roger Maris home run analysis, those are not the relevant odds because there are thousands of mutual fund managers, over 6,000 currently, and there were many 15-year periods in which the feat could have been accomplished. So the relevant question is, if thousands of people are tossing coins once a year and have been doing so for decades, what are the chances that one of them, for some period of 15 years or longer, will toss all heads? that probability is far, far higher than the odds of simply tossing 15 heads in a row. To make this explanation concrete, suppose 1,000 fund managers, certainly an underestimate, had each tossed a coin once a year starting in 1999, the year Miller began his streak. After the first year, about half of them would have tossed heads. After 2 years, about one quarter of them would have tossed two heads. After the third year, one eighth of them would have tossed three heads, and so on. By then, some who had tossed tails would have started to drop out of the game, but that wouldn't affect the analysis because they had already failed. The chances that after 15 years, a particular coin tosser would have tossed all heads are then 1 in 32,768. The chances that someone among the 1,000 who had started tossing coins in 1991 would have tossed all heads are much higher, about 3%. Finally, there is no reason to consider only those who started tossing coins in 1991. The fund managers could have started in 1990 or 1970 or any other year in the era of modern mutual funds. Since the writers for the Credit Suisse newsletter used 40 years in their discussion, I calculated the odds that by chance some manager in the last four decades would beat the market each year for some period of 15 years or longer. That latitude increased the odds again to the probability I quoted earlier, of almost 3 out of 4. So, rather than being surprised by Miller's streak, I would say, if no one had achieved a streak like Miller's, you could have legitimately complained that all those highly paid managers were performing worse than they would have by blind chance. The coin toss experiment is imperfect, of course. For it to apply precisely to the mutual fund universe, you'd have to assume that on chance alone, a given fund manager would have 50% odds of beating the market. Well, that seems unknowable. There's no way to discern, for example, whether Bill Miller was a phenomenally talented stock picker who simply made a disastrous decision to double down on financials at a terrible time and near the end of his glittering career, or if randomness, in a sense, had just selected him to have an unprecedented 15-year streak. All the same, we think there are some profound, if obvious, lessons here. Mostly about hero worship in the investment world and how we fail to understand or try to avoid understanding the role of luck in our lives and in the lives of those we emulate. It is a behavioral quirk that we feel the need to explain what we really don't understand, and because we're not good at understanding randomness, we tend to think that excellent outcomes are mostly the result of great decisions made by wise individuals, even in situations where we can't verify if that's the case. That won't change, and we're a forgetful species. Eventually, maybe not for years, but eventually, the economy and the markets will be healed, and new fund managers will grace multiple barons' covers and be elevated in the minds of their peers to planes higher than what is justified or reasonable. The cautionary tale of Bill Miller will soon be forgotten. Given the way his tenure as head of Legg Mason Value Trust has ended, perhaps he can take solace in that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly my theory about Warren Buffett, and I know it's not exactly PC to say it, but as I've said to you before, on a very, very simple level, if out of a planet of 6.5 billion souls, there was not one single person who did what Warren Buffett has done by chance, then I would say that was the strange phenomenon to deal with. Not the high likelihood that Warren Buffett was indeed the one person singled out by chance to claim that feat. And if you have any lingering doubts, do please be my guest. Listen to Warren Buffett talk for 5 to 10 minutes, preferably in some kind of video made by a TV station at some point in the last few years. At that point, I think you will sympathize much more keenly with my own supposition. All right, well, let me just look to see if we have any emails. I find myself having been on the wrong page here, so let me see. I don't think we do. Andy Celsius writes in to say the New York breakfast morning is 213-1 positive. What did they put in the eggnog? Well, it's interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, you've probably all seen, you know, there is a great deal of, there is a very great deal of upward movement in the stock market today. It's up 315 points. In my experience of a market which has been going down and in a bear market overall, a day like this, out of the blue, where the stock market rallies for absolutely no reason whatsoever, at least no reason that I can identify, is as bearish as it gets for the market. That is an absolute clear statement that the market is about to fall and fall in a huge and grim manner. It's par for the course. I've seen it over and over again, and this is just another example of the same thing. Let me see what's coming up here. I believe that Matt is typing me something. I may or may not be somebody who wants to talk, but it didn't happen yet. So, yes, it did. Question from Twitter. Who benefits from the collapse, and what can we do in Europe? That's from Jerome. Who benefits from the collapse? Basically, people who sell short in the stock market. People, basically, who see it coming. I mean, for example, if you have bought bonds in the last few months, you've done very well. If you have sold commodities short, you've done very well, and so you have with gold and silver as well. Basically, the collapse implies deflation, as I've said many times, and if you can identify deflation and what to do in a deflationary environment, in other words, understand that assets fall in relation to money, and thereby sell those assets, whether they're houses, you know, commodities, stocks, whatever they may be. If you understand that, if you are in complete agreement with the deflationary scenario, then you will sell assets, hold on to money, preferably choosing the right money, and I'll talk a little bit about the dollar in a second. The success in this game is the long term. It is the vision to see what's going to happen over the long term, which is actually much, much easier than to see what's going to happen over the short term. I don't think there were many people on Friday in the shortened session who thought we would be up over 300 points by Monday lunchtime, for example. So short-term predictions are always very tough. But in your case, Jerome, basically the collapse in Europe would involve moving out of Europe, I would say, certainly moving all your money out of Europe and trying to find a country which may be more stable, for example, Singapore comes to mind. Singapore is going to suffer greatly from the lapse in the West and the economic depression that we're seeing right now. But it will recover more quickly. It will, being a credit nation, bounce back much more swiftly, which I don't mean in the next 2 or 3 years, I mean possibly 5 to 10 years, but they will, countries that are credited nations will invariably do better than debtor nations such as the United States, Japan, and Europe. So hopefully that's done some justice to your question, and just to follow on from that question, let me see what I can give you in terms of the dollar. I've said that I would talk a little bit about why the dollar is set to rally, and actually rally quite substantially, I believe, over the foreseeable future. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, it's to do with supply and demand. And let's start by seeing how supply has diminished in the dollar in the last 3 years. You'll remember that in 2008, the banks began cutting back on new loans. Hundreds of billions of mortgages went into foreclosure. And combined, the net overall expansion of credit outside the federal government plunged by a shocking 83% from the prior year to a meager $500 billion. Just think about that. Think about what the impact would have been of an 83% plunge in the stock market or in any sector of the economy. Yet here you had precisely that kind of a collapse in the most fundamental source of stimulus for the U.S. economy, credit. But if that sounds bad, wait for the next installment. In 2009, as millions of Americans defaulted on their mortgages, auto loans, and credit cards, and as thousands of banks tightened up their lending standards for overall new credit, we actually witnessed a massive liquidation of private credit. And when the dust settled, the Fed tabulated a net destruction of credit to the tune of $1.99 trillion in mortgages, consumer credit, bank loans, and other non-federal debts. It was literally the biggest decline of credit outstanding in recorded history. And if it had ended there, it would have been bad enough, but it didn't. The credit carnage continued in 2010 and is still taking place now in 2011. So that all told, in the 30 months between January the 1st, 2009 and June the 30th, 2011, the U.S. has witnessed the net destruction of nearly $3.2 trillion in non-federal credit. Now remember, credit is the stuff that drives the U.S. economy, that millions of American families are addicted to in order to maintain their spending habits and lifestyle, that businesses count on to keep their sales and earnings flowing. So now do you understand why the economy is stagnating? It's quite simple when you think about it. Washington is hogging nearly all the new credit available to finance its out-of-control deficits. But nearly everyone else is sucking hind teeth, or worse, getting kicked out of the pen entirely. No wonder households are suffering such huge income declines despite the so-called recovery. To be effective, Ben Bernanke would have to print up enough money to cover the entire shortfall. He knows it's a losing battle. He's learning right now, as I speak to you, ladies and gentlemen, that his ridiculous experiment with printing money is a colossal, massive failure, an intellectual catastrophe for which the country is now and will be for the foreseeable future taking the consequences. What a miscalculation! What an absurd mistake from an arrogant and idiotic dreamer. But it does tell you why the supply of dollars is being sucked out of the economy and why, therefore, the demand is outstripping the supply and, consequently, why the dollar is rising. Well, Jerome, I hope you stayed in for that one because it will probably be of some use to you. Right. Let's take an email from Kevin Moran, who says, White Plains did not have booming sales on Friday. Cashiers at Walmart complained of being bored. Some cashiers at major stores didn't record a sale until 8 a.m., despite being open since midnight. Woodbury Common, a very large outlet mall, 45 minutes north of White Plains, was very busy starting at midnight, but by 8 o'clock there were plenty of parking places. A few more pieces of information. 1. 44% were buying for themselves per CNBC. 2. Young people under 30 increased their presence sharply on Black Friday. Why not? They were up until midnight, but certainly not at 8 a.m. Did they buy? Kevin Moran. Thank you very much for that, Kevin. Art from Long Island would like to talk about money market funds. Art, welcome to the show. You're on.
Thank you. I have a money have money in a money market fund. It's not a regular bank. It's
credit union?
Credit union. I couldn't think of it offhand.
Okay.
And so I'm wondering how safe it's in a credit union, and I should probably get out anyway.
Well, I think credit unions are good. I mean, I don't. I'm more in favor of people taking their money out of the big banks and putting them into credit unions. But remember that money market funds themselves are not, germane to any particular financial institution. Money market funds are set up by companies who, hope to make a tiny spread on these funds. They're real businesses, just like any other business. And you need to know that they are vulnerable in the same way as any other credit institution is vulnerable. In other words, if the credit seizes up, for example, in Europe, and they can't get that money out, they may find themselves in the position of having to break the buck and reduce their net asset value per share from below a dollar. So don't get lulled into a false sense of security by thinking that just because you're with a credit union, your money market fund is safe. It may well not be. But then again, Art and everybody else, and I've always said to you, if you want to be safe, and you should all want to be safe, you need to take your money out of the commercial money market funds and put them with the Treasury bill money market funds, the ones that just invest in Treasury bills. And again, I always issue the sort of caveat that you need to look under the hood of these so-called Treasury bill money market funds to make sure that they don't contain large percentages of GSEs, like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which they sometimes do. They're quite shameless about it. They call them like a Treasury bill money market fund, and then you find that lo and behold, there's not more than just a very small percentage of the money invested in T-bills, and the rest goes any old where. So other than for that, Art, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, a very great pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show. Then I get Michael Reidinger, who writes in and says, Hello, Richard, how can we play a dollar run-up? Thanks for your work, Michael R. Mike, the best way, in fact, I'm glad you asked that particular question, because the way not to play currencies is by buying currencies on the forex market against the dollar. That is a shortcut to suicide, because the leverage is so huge. You're probably putting up 3 to 5% of your own money to control the money that you buy in foreign currencies, and that will wipe you out, if the currency should happen to move by, said, 3 or 5%. But don't do that. Buy the exchange-traded funds, the ETFs of the currency you're interested in, or sell. In the case of the dollar, you can. There is an ETF which plays the dollar on the upside. There's also one which plays the dollar on the low side. You can buy these ETFs, and they have relatively low risk. They trade like stocks in the stock market, and they are specifically designed with people like you in mind who want to take a position in a currency but want a relatively reduced rate of risk. So there are several of them. I won't give you any recommendations because obviously you have to decide what kind of comparison you want to make in your investment, i.e., do you want to buy the dollar against the yen, the dollar against the euro, the dollar against the Swiss franc. There are all kinds of different ways in which you can do this, but that's definitely the way to go for the average retail investor such as yourself, Mike. So thank you very much for that question. I don't believe I've dealt with it before. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure being with you today. We are, of course, coming towards the close of the show. I don't want to really get involved in any new discussion today. I've given you quite a lot of things to think about. I will, tell you in conclusion that the unemployment rate for males between 25 and 34 with high school diplomas is 14.4%, which is up from 6.1% before the downturn 4 years ago and far above the 9% stated declared national rate. It's even bleaker for younger people, 22.4% for high school graduates 20 to 24 years old, up from 10.4% 4 years ago. This is a disaster for society at large. It gives absolutely no sense of economic independence to young people. It reflects a generation of Americans facing one of the weakest job markets in modern history. If you have people like a generation of young males who aren't well connected to the labor market and who don't feel strong ownership of community or society because they haven't benefited from it, frankly, this is a quick pass to social unrest, to violence, to crime. It's absolutely horrendous. The share of men aged 25 to 34 with their parents jumped to 18.6 this year, up from 14.2% 4 years ago, the highest level since 1960. And that's, by the way, according to the Census Bureau. For such a person, everybody has failed him. The Republicans, the Democrats, education's failed him, marriage has failed. It must look like a fraud. The American dream, the hopes for a better life, the consumer society, the housing boom, the suburbs. Where did it all go? The happy family. The promises of 2,000 years of accumulated civilization, gone, just up in smoke. Sitting at home, watching TV, playing video games. This is the lot of a veritable army of angry people, ladies and gentlemen, waiting for the moment to go out on the rampage and commit horrific acts of violence. The moment approaches, ladies and gentlemen. Take care of yourselves. I will be back on Friday. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.